From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the presidential race began 1 year, 7 months, and 19 days ago when Ted Cruz became the first major candidate to declare he was running. Now that we've reached the end of the campaigns, we are gathering one last time for our weekly 2016 roundtable.
Here and Now!
That is the last time you will ever hear that. So lovers of the jingle, we're sorry. And haters, you're going to have to find something new to hate.
End of an era.
Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post and visiting journalism professor at the University of Colorado, is with us. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Peter.
And Rick Klein, also with us, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Do I finally get to sing?
Well, that's what I thought you were going to do.
2016.
There you go.
Sounds so sweet at the end, yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so much to talk about right now. And Rick, I think one of the big questions is, what kind of president is Donald Trump going to be? Is he going to be a deal maker who is not an ideologue, or is he going to be someone who really appeals to his base of supporters?
Donald Trump told us once that there are two Donald Trumps, and I am inclined to believe him. We've seen the two Donald Trumps even in the wake of his election on Tuesday night. We saw historic, humble, kind of Mexico City-style Donald Trump, where he seemed to be soaking it all in. We saw that yesterday at the Oval Office and in Washington. And then he turns around and tweets about how the protesters are unfair. That's the other side. I think we're going to get
both. But then he turned around and tweeted again and said, well, actually, these nice small protesters, we're all going to come together.
Three Trumps. Now, I think we're going to see the deal maker at times. We're also going to see a president who channels his base, social media fueled, and lets the country engage with him in ways that we haven't seen. I really think we are in for constant surprises from a candidate that surprised us from the start.
Greg, it feels like a moment for reflection, I guess, at the end of this whole thing. Have we learned anything about ourselves as a country through all this?
We probably have learned that there's some parts of the country that we don't understand very well. I think a lot of the interior part of the country that went for Donald Trump was, you know, a part of the country that was really, really frustrated. And I'm not sure they were really reflected that extensively in the coverage, whether we're talking about television or newspapers or what have you. And I think that's what drove the surprise. The other thing, to go back to your first point, the one thing that's interesting about Trump, to underscore the dealmaker part, this guy comes in really not owing anybody anything, not big media, not big money, not Republicans, not Democrats, other special interests. So he can kind of do whatever he wants to do. And so, you know, he's going to surprise us. He's going to be combative. But he also has a great opportunity that a lot of politicians coming into the presidency don't have.
But does he owe people like Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani, Sarah Palin?
He owes those voters more than anything else. I mean, you know, he didn't pick Giuliani or Newt Gingrich for the vice presidency, and they didn't walk away from him. I think that, you know, he basically indicted the entire establishment, and Gingrich and Giuliani are really a part of that, too.
But, Rick, you we're talking here about whether or not he was able to drain the swamp, were his words. There is some concern that his transition team is staffed by lobbyists. It's staffed with people who have direct ties to the energy and financial industries. He'd promised to step away from this sort of thing. How's that going over in Washington?
I think the swamp laid out the red carpet for him yesterday. The question is what kind of draining we're talking about. And he's going to have to employ some insiders. But I agree with Greg. I think we are going to see a guy who comes in without the loyalties that usually bind an incoming president or incoming politician of having to check certain boxes with certain interest groups. He's not going to care about most of them. That's not the same as saying he's going to be free of special interests. He is going to be all over with lots of conflicts of interest at every levels of his administration, even in foreign policy, as well as lots of financial issues and criminal justice areas. But he is not going to have to say, I need to do this to make sure the base is there. He once said that he could walk down Fifth Avenue and people still vote for him. He tested that proposition, and I think there's something to that.
I think actually it wasn't that he would walk down Fifth Avenue and people would vote for him. It's that he could shoot somebody.
Oh, I missed the detail. You're right. You're right.
Yes. Important detail. So let's talk about these protests that have been going on. This is what was happening in Portland, Oregon last night.
All persons must leave the area immediately by traveling to the east. This is an unlawful gathering.
that sound from Coin TV. Greg, a lot of people very unhappy around the country. There is talk of trying to convince electors to not use their electoral votes for Donald Trump. There is talk of California seceding because of what happened. Yeah. What do you make of this anger, and especially because Hillary Clinton will have won the popular vote?
Yeah, I think that drives it. And people are just so disappointed and really shocked and angry. And I think this is just part of some catharsis that, you know, needs to sort of play out. But hopefully it will not last, you know, too long, because that is really not what this country is about. The peaceful transition of power involves the acceptance of the election. You know, people exercise their right to vote, and they won. And as people tend to say, elections have consequences, but they also have responsibilities. And everyone's anxious to see how Donald Trump and the Republicans exercise the opportunity and responsibility that they have
now.
Well,
let's talk about that, because Trump made a trip to Capitol Hill yesterday. Here he is talking about what his first priorities will be.
Whether it's health care or immigration, so many different things. We'll be working on them very rapidly, and I think we'll be putting things up pretty quickly.
And Trump was with someone that he's clashed with over the past few months, House Speaker Paul Ryan. Here's what Ryan said.
Donald Trump had one of the most impressive victories we've ever seen. And we're going to turn that victory into progress for the American people. And we are now talking about how we're going to hit the ground running to make sure that we can get this country turned around and make America great again.
Rick, water under the bridge, I guess. He even used Donald Trump's tagline there, make America great again. How do you see Trump working with a Republican Congress?
That was the second most striking thing of the day to me after the Obama meeting, was that Paul Ryan said that. Look, I think they are coming to terms with the fact that they're going to have to work together. I think the fact that Paul Ryan has said Donald Trump has earned a mandate and they could work together to make America great again, that's a signal that he's on board the Trump train. Now, will it last? Will they clash? Of course they will clash. It will not last. However, they are going to enter this realizing that they can, to borrow a phrase from the other side, stronger together. And I can see this teamwork working in terms of pushing an agenda, at least initially. Paul Ryan is saying to his folks, I'm on board for this. And Trump is going to say right back at him, I'm not going to try to oust you. I'm going to let you keep that job as long as we're friends.
What do you see them actually accomplishing most likely in the first 100 days?
I think the repeal of Obamacare is probably the biggest legislative thing. It's actually going to be hard to do to get past the Senate, but I think in terms of a push, that will happen. I think they're going to start work on immigration. I'm most intrigued by his talk, Donald Trump's talk about an infrastructure bill, a jobs bill that would involve rebuilding America, because that's an area where you could really scramble the politics. To Greg's point, you wouldn't have the same kind of interest groups at play, and you could get some Democrats on board. That might be the most interesting and most unexpected thing out of the first 100 days.
And Greg,
I agree with that. I think right out the box, it's the economy, stupid. It's about jobs. And coming out with a infrastructure bill that creates jobs, that creates some bipartisanship, would be an important signal to send in the first 100 days.
Greg, what did Hillary Clinton do wrong as we look back? And who's the leader of the Democratic Party right now?
Well, in terms of what she did wrong, and I'm not a political pundit or anything, but, you know, she made the same kind of mistakes this time that she did in 2008, and underestimating the importance of the caucuses, and in this case, underestimating the importance of being present in certain communities herself, not sending surrogates. I think, you know, when you look at the turnout in 2012 for Obama and now, and almost all the groups where Obama prevailed, she did worse than he did in 2012. So her vaunted turnout, the vote machine, just did not come through for her. In terms of who's in the head of the Democratic Party now, it's either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, I would guess.
So you see a pivot far to the left.
Yeah,
Rick,
I do.
What do you think?
I agree with that entirely. I think the fact that you're seeing Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer agree on their choice of the next DNC chair is Keith Ellison, a Muslim American younger congressman from Minnesota, who does hail from the Sanders-Warren wing of the party, suggests that they see the power on the left. And I think that gets to the problem with the Clinton campaign, one of the many problems, which is that this was a top-down campaign in a bottom-up year. They tried to stifle the competition. They tried to choke off the money. They tried to stop the Sanders insurgency at every turn and tell Democrats that she was the choice, rather than listen to Democrats about their priorities.
Rick, I want to ask you something that I've heard over the last few days, which is, well, Bernie Sanders would have won. Do you think that, as the political director for ABC News, do you think Bernie Sanders would have won if he had run against Trump?
I think it's unknowable. I think it's like saying that the Red Sox would have beaten the Cubs instead. It would have been a different series. It would have been a different campaign that would have played out along different lines. But there was something genuine about the Bernie Sanders phenomena that would have given the Trump campaign a run for its money in terms of tapping into the fears, the resentments, the anger that's out there in America in both political parties.
Well, I said it was an end of an era for the jingle singers. It really does feel like we've been at this for a long time. We have. So
hopefully next time in 4 years we can limit the length of the campaign.
Hopefully.
Oh boy, that would be nice.
Bipartisan agreement.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post and visiting journalism professor at the University of Colorado. We will say you guys are welcome back anytime, even if it doesn't have a jingle to go along with it. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you very much.
Forbes has called fashion designer Tommy Hilfiger Turnaround Tommy. At one point in the 1990s, it seemed like the brand's red, white, and blue logo appeared everywhere. Printed on billboards, on shirts and jeans, bathing suits, towels, perfume bottles. The company was founded in 1985, it went public in 1992, and it's had many ups and downs since then. Tommy Hilfiger joins me now for our View from the Top conversation. He has a new book out called American Dreamer, My Life in Fashion and Business. Tommy Hilfiger, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, I had an epiphany while I was reading your book that you are probably the reason that I wore clothes that were two sizes too big for me for like an entire decade in the 90s.
So you were a millennial, I guess, right? You're just outside of being millennial.
Barely a millennial. But, you know, I want to ask you about that because you write about carpenter jeans in the 1990s. I know a lot of people who wore carpenter jeans. There was that hammer loop there by the knee, which, you know, I never carried a hammer around, so I don't know why we had that. But what was the deal with the fashion in the 90s?
Well, you know, really what it was, we took workwear and athletic wear, made it very cool, made it very oversized. You know, at that time, Calvin Klein was very black and gray and slim cut, and Ralph Lauren was very Brooks Brothers looking, and I wanted to make it really like sort of off the wall. So I took my favorite items, athletic wear, hockey jerseys, football jerseys, all sorts of like varsity jackets and carpenter pants, overalls, and injected coolness and newness into the items.
Why so oversized?
Well, you know, what happened is a lot of the street kids started buying sizes that were much larger than their own regular size would be. So if a guy had a 30 waist, he would buy 36. And that was a look. In fashion, everything is cyclical. So that was a look that is now coming back, believe it or not.
Yeah. Well, you're known over the years for your connection to celebrities and to hip hop. I wonder if that was what helped your brand take off, because I'm thinking back to that time that Snoop Dogg came out on the stage of Saturday Night Live wearing Hilfiger. Was that the moment?
That was a big moment because Snoop wore that on SNL and it lit the brand on fire because a lot of the street kids started wearing it and with the big logos, they were like billboards on the street. But at the same time, I always wanted my clothes to be worn by a very broad audience. I wanted everyone to wear them, men, women, children of all different backgrounds, ages, sizes. And therefore, I priced my collection to be affordable designer.
But you're also connected to so many celebrities over the years. I mentioned Snoop Dogg, but we have a lot of Rafa Nadal fans here who you've partnered with, Jennifer Lopez. I mean, do you feel that to make it in the business today that you have to have these affiliations with celebrities to sell clothes?
Well, look, some people think so and some people don't. I've always thought that aligning with the right celebrities is how to build a fan base. We had this group perform for us at Macy's during one of our fashion shows, and the group was called Destiny's Child. And this lead singer was this beautiful, talented girl by the name of Beyoncé.
Heard of her.
She became the face of our Tommy Hilfiger True Star fragrance. Kate Hudson, David Bowie, Iman, Mick Jagger have all been associated with my brand. And I have always felt that if I team up with the right musicians or the right Hollywood stars or the right athletes, their fans will also come to us. But I had to really like their music or I had to really be attracted to them.
Well, you were one of the first fashion designers to take your company public. But then in the early 2000s, you did have some troubles. You had to delist from the stock exchange. You took yourself private again. What went wrong there in the early 2000s?
I think we overexpanded. The business got too big. We were ubiquitous. We were in every store on every street corner. And when that happens, the customer says, enough, no more, don't want to see it anymore. And then you have to retrench. I think that we were fortunate that our business in Europe was doing really well. So we looked at what was going on over there and we said, aha, the European customer with more sophisticated taste doesn't want to wear big logos. They want to wear something either logo-free or something with a tiny logo, slimmer fit. So we took a page out of the book of Tommy Hilfiger Europe that was doing so well. We reestablished the brand in the States. We cleaned up the distribution, and then the brand took off again.
So did you have a sophistication problem in the United States?
I think when you become over distributed and when you are selling on every street corner, the sophistication level and the value of the brand gets depleted.
So for a person whose brand is his name, I imagine that was probably a pretty painful experience for you to go through, to watch something with your name attached to it failing.
I have had many starts and stops. Many times it's been running out of money. Sometimes it's been as a result of making mistakes. But in reality, you have to continue following the dream.
But you had self-doubt, I imagine.
A lot of self-doubt at times, but then you have to say, okay, look, I could either bathe in this self-doubt or I could stand up, brush off the seat of my pants and go forward.
I want to ask you about manufacturing because we have had an ongoing discussion in this election about American companies making products overseas.
Right.
What do you think it will take, and maybe this is a pipe dream, tell me if you think it is, for American clothes to be made in America again?
It would be great. It would be fantastic because I want Americans to work. Problem is we don't have the factories here in America to manufacture the type of merchandise that has all this detail in it that we need. But at this point in time, a lot of those factories have moved out, closed down. I mean, my family has been affected by it. My family, I'm from Elmira, New York, where they used to have typewriter factories, glass factories, shoe factories. They're all closed.
So are you saying, though, that it's not about the cost of manufacturing clothes in the United States? It's the fact that the talent, the skill, the infrastructure just isn't there.
Well, it's not there because it was at one point about cost, that people felt they could make things in China or somewhere else cheaper. So therefore, they moved out of America and moved into different countries to get better pricing. But, you know, a lot of this could have been caused by unions demanding too much money, workers not satisfied with wages. Workers thinking or factory owners thinking, oh, people will never move out. People will never move out of America. And they were greedy with the prices and they were complacent. I only wish those factories still existed in America.
Sure, but you're a wealthy, successful designer who's done well over the years. I can imagine people in Ohio or upstate New York would say, Tommy Hilfiger, build me a factory to make your clothes and I'll work there.
The thing is being a clothing designer is different than being a factory owner. Being a factory owner is a certain kind of skill and a certain kind of labor-intensive process that I don't profess to really master in. I think I'm really very skillful in marketing and design, but I can't even thread a needle myself. I wouldn't know how to make something, so I have to go to factories. I have to find factories. And by the way, we make as much as we can in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is still very proficient at making T-shirts, making socks, I mean, making certain things. So we make whatever we can make here in the United States and hope that eventually there will be more factories here to make more of everything.
Well, at this stage in your career, you are more of an advisor, an ambassador to the Tommy Hilfiger brand. But I want to ask you, what trends are you looking at that the rest of us don't even know that we'll be buying come springtime or next year?
Well, if I told you that, my competition would be sitting, listening to the radio, thinking that they should go out and do what I'm doing, because we're really leading the trend now. But I can give you a very interesting story about Gigi Hadid. So Gigi Hadid is Southern California girl, beautiful, 25 million Instagram followers. We invited her to collaborate and to design the Gigi Tommy collection. She came into our design studio, and she was wearing jeans that were high-waisted jeans, but, I mean, I'm talking high, like, you know, 5 inches above her belly button. Hmm. So we made high-waisted jeans because she wanted high-waisted jeans.
Huh.
Guess what? I guess they sold out completely. So high-waisted jeans are now the trend in jeanswear. We are now thinking, okay, what next, what next, what next, what next? But these are secrets. These are top secrets.
Sure.
And we're not going to reveal them until we reveal them on the runway with the right program.
Well, thank goodness Gigi Hadid did not come wearing carpenter pants. That trend is over for now.
Look, if she had come wearing carpenter pants, I guarantee you that trend would ignite again.
All right. Tommy Hilfiger, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Great talking to you.
Oh, the hammer loop on jeans. What a bittersweet memory. Hilfiger's new book is called American Dreamer, My Life in Fashion and Business. We'll link to it at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
What does the election of Donald Trump as president mean for trade? Well, joining us now is Marilyn Geewax. She's senior business editor at NPR. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
So it's only been 3 days since the election, but it does seem like U.S. trade policy is already changing.
Yeah, it really has changed a lot, actually, just this week. So we can start with that one big thing, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. We can declare that dead.
Hmm.
This is that huge trade deal. It was supposed to involve the United States and 11 other countries that are around the Pacific Rim. So we're talking about Japan, Australia, Singapore. By tying those countries together, President Obama hoped to create this thing he was calling a pivot to Asia. He wanted us to work more closely with those Asian partners to counterbalance China. But, you know, they had years of negotiations. He finally gets this deal. He wants it to go straight to Congress for this up or down vote. And he hoped that he could get that after the election, that the lame duck Congress would just take it up and pass it. But that hope is really now entirely gone. Trump's been very clear that he does not want TPP, or at least not the Obama version of it. And Republican lawmakers are just not going to cross their new president. And, you know, that means that right after the election, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, he's a Republican, said that this existing TPP deal is never going to get a vote during the Obama era. So that is that.
That's that for TPP, this potential trade deal that the U.S. would have been a part of. But what about existing trade deals, including NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that's been in place for more than 20 years?
Well, Trump had made his opposition to NAFTA really one of the key points in his campaign, and he's going to follow through on that. He says he's going to renegotiate the deal. But of course, when you have a deal that involves Canada and Mexico and it's been signed by Congress, that's a tough thing to just – you can't just tear it up.
Right.
I mean, it's a treaty with other countries. So you have to get everybody to reopen the talks. But what's interesting is it looks like Canada and Mexico say, yeah, we'll go along with reopening those talks.
Well, here's the Canadian ambassador to the U.S., David McNaughton, speaking on the CBC.
Obviously, any trade deal can be improved. And to the degree that the president-elect of the United States wants to see improvements to NAFTA, you know, we'd be happy to sit down and talk. We've got some things that I think we'd like to see, and happy to have that discussion with him when he settles in.
And you say Mexico is also interested in talking.
Yes, Mexico's economy minister said that they'd be willing to talk at it too, but about it. But Jeremy, you can't just, as I said, you know, it's not something you just tear apart or throw it all out. This has been in place since 1994, so there are all these supply chains. That think about the auto industry. They have car parts made in Mexico. They assemble some in Canada. They sell things in the United States. It's a very complex supply chain that goes all up and down the continent, and that's certainly true too for a lot of our farmers who have deals where, you know, if you grow potatoes in Idaho, you want to sell them to Mexico. So it's not something that is easily changed, but apparently it can be changed.
So it sounds like a lot of uncertainty ahead when it comes to trade, and we'll be watching and we'll be talking to you about it. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giewax, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Jeremy.
It's Veterans Day, and we want to take some time to hear the voices of those who served. Theodore Cummings was a Marine during World War II and fought in the bloody Battle of Guadalcanal.
A sailor gave me a can of peaches. He opened it up for me. Big can of peaches and that syrup. It was champagne. Beautiful, that guy was.
That sound is part of the Library of Congress Veterans History Project collection. The project's director is Karen Lloyd. She's a retired Army pilot. Colonel Lloyd, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. So first, just tell us about this project.
It's an amazing project. It's volunteer-based, and so I would ask that all of your listeners really think about how they can participate with the veteran that's in their life. Studies have shown that 62% of the nation's are related to a veteran in some way, and if not related, then find a veteran in your neighborhood and ask them their story, and not just asking their story, but really listen to what they say and what they did. I think that you'll discover that some of it really resonates with you about their service to the country. I mean, it's fascinating to hear what they did and saw or felt while they were in uniform.
Well, let's listen to some of the recordings that you have. And by the way, the project also includes original photographs and written histories, but the real crux of it is the oral history. So let's listen to some of that. Robert Chenoweth was an Army private in Vietnam. He was a prisoner of war for 5 years, and he was held at the camp that was often referred to as the Hanoi Hilton.
In a situation like that, you always have people who are kind, and then every once in a while you have people who are not kind. Yeah. What was difficult was the fact that you were always hungry, the fact that you were confined. You know, you couldn't do what you wanted or go where you wanted. And there was some hostility. I mean, there was some anger towards you, you know. Yeah. We experienced that more in the countryside, I think, than we did in the prison camps, because in the countryside, people were being directly affected by what the American planes were doing.
That was Private Robert Chenoweth describing his time in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. Colonel Lloyd, when you hear something like that, as a veteran yourself, what do you think?
I am just amazed by the different things that these veterans pick up on and how they relate it to how their life is today. We have another member who is a veteran who was in the Hanoi Hilton. His name is John Stavast, and his collection is really amazing because he chose to write in a diary all the different things to keep his mind active, and we have a copy of that. And we also have a copy of the reunion pictures, and one of the things that strikes me about that reunion picture is if I'm having a bad day and I ever need to understand what joy is all about, the picture of him meeting up with his family at the reunion site is of pure joy, and it's absolutely fascinating to see.
When you read that diary, what did you learn about his experience there, how he kept his mind sharp?
He taught himself French along with the other individuals that were there with him. And the other thing that he did was he kept track of the new POWs that arrived. And what really gave me goosebumps is that on the 26th of November, Senator John McCain, who wasn't a senator at the time, arrived, and there it is, written down. We actually have his as well. And so that's the importance of reaching out and getting a variety of different interviews from your friends and from your neighbors and from your family, because what we're discovering is they're all connected in some way. And that makes them even more fascinating.
Well, let's hear from another one. Clara Hoke was a nurse during World War I, and in 1971, she talked about the job she was faced with when there was a desperate need for nurses at the time.
were only about 30 nurses there at this time when I got there. And they were very, very much in need of nursing care there. So nobody could stay off duty too long with ailments or what have you. They evidently had my record and put me in surgery. I was in surgery practically all the time after that.
So that clip was from 40 years ago or more. Let's hear a more modern one, a clip from Takeda Shande Perkins. She's a Marine staff sergeant who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And here she is talking about her experiences in Iraq.
A lot of times when you achieve certain things as a woman, certain males and not all males, I'm not trying to stereotype, but they would immediately say, oh, she only got it because she was a woman. So you had to always not just do better, but you had to do twice as good as your male counterpart in order for some of them to think you were equal.
So, Colonel Lloyd, I played those back to back because I think the juxtaposition is really remarkable. On the one hand, the story of a nurse from World War I. On the other hand, a woman who is really at the front lines. It really demonstrates how different the role of women in the military has gotten over the years.
Oh, it certainly has. And as they say now, there is no real front line. It's everywhere you are. And so there have been some really good decisions made to at least acknowledge that there is no front line, that the front line really is everywhere that you are and where the women are. I could identify when she talked about, well, it's not all the guys, but sometimes, not just sometimes, but you certainly do feel like you have to be at least twice as good as the guys to get the same level of credit.
You experienced that in your own service.
Oh, I certainly did. I certainly did. I didn't experience it in my first assignment, which was they were introducing women into the 2nd Infantry Division in Korea. Mm. But I went from there to flight school. And I will tell you that I was told more than once by my classmates that I was taking a guy's place. And you know, that just made me want to try harder and do better. And so if they thought that was going to cause me not to want to be where I was, they were mistaken.
Well, Staff Sergeant Perkins obviously is a woman, but also an African-American, which represents two of the groups that you don't really hear from very often in this project.
Well, you're exactly right. We've done a survey of the collections that we do have, and we are reaching out. We're looking for women. We're looking for chaplains. We're looking for Native Americans. We're looking for Hispanic Americans. We're looking for African Americans. We know that our collections aren't as diverse as we need for them to be. We're looking for all the different conflicts that folks have served in. We're looking for across the board. And that's why we need your viewers to reach out to their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, and ask them what their stories were and have that conversation. I mean, Veterans Day is a great day to think about, wow, the veterans in my life. And then perhaps over the Thanksgiving Day holiday, arrange so that you can interview them or at least have a conversation with them about what their service was like. For example, I know that you've recently interviewed Chuck Hagel.
Mm, yeah.
And we have the privilege of having both he and his brother, Tom Hagel's interviews. And something that Tom said that really resonated with me was, you know, everybody talks about the Vietnam War, but really there were millions of Vietnam Wars, and it's getting those stories that's going to add to the depth of the experience that other Americans, all Americans, are going to be able to have to learn what it was like from each of those different perspectives.
Well, and Vietnam vets are getting older. We used to talk about how World War II vets were dying off, but the generation that fought in Vietnam is also aging.
I must tell you that I feel that personally. My husband was a Vietnam vet, got a Silver Star. I didn't get his story before he passed away last summer. And I must tell you that those lost voices, no one knows that better than I do from a firsthand perspective. And I must encourage everyone, all of your listeners, to really think about those voices that we can't afford to lose. We really do need every one of those stories so we have a better sense of what it really was like.
Colonel Karen Lloyd is a retired Army pilot, and she's director of the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. Karen, thank you, and thank you for your service.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll tell you how to submit your own interviews with vets to the Library of Congress on our website, hereandnow.org. And this does hit close to home for me. My father was a lieutenant in the Army's 9th Infantry Division in Vietnam. He volunteered to serve at a time when many wouldn't dream of it. As a boy, I'd sometimes ask him about his tour. He spent a year patrolling the Mekong River Delta, I know that. he and his men laid mines in the rice paddies. I always wanted to hear more. There were two purple hearts hanging on a plaque in the hallway of our home. I barely knew how he got them. I was starving for war stories. But even then, I could tell he didn't want to spend much time explaining to his son what he saw there and what he asked others to do. As a grown man who lives a life in relative peace, I can respect that. Happy Veterans Day, Dad, and to everyone who's been brave enough to wear the uniform.
This weekend, Dave Chappelle returns to TV as the host of the first Saturday Night Live post-election. Chappelle has been away from TV for a long time now. His groundbreaking sketch comedy show ran on Comedy Central from 2003 until 2006.
Kids, drugs is all around you. How will I know when drugs is around, you might be asking? Well, I tell you. You with them magic markers, what you think that is? Some kind of crayon? No, take that cap off and sniff it, and you'll be high.
Well, Dave Chappelle left that show abruptly, and the network canceled it, so this is an important moment for him. And joining us to talk about it is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, and this is a big moment to have Dave Chappelle host SNL. Why now, do you think?
Well, you know, Lorne Michaels is television's savviest producer, and I think he has really deftly handled how SNL has approached this election. Now, you can agree or disagree with his choices, and I've disagreed with some of them, but having Trump as a guest host and then having Alec Baldwin come on and do this devastating parody, and now he's got Dave Chappelle coming on. I mean, he's one of the nation's most incisive comics of color, and he talks a lot about race and society, and now he's going to get a chance to come back to television, and he's going to have a platform on Saturday Night Live, first time hosting, to talk about what it means that Trump is now our president, among other things. And there's a 16-second promo on YouTube that came out, you know, where he's just walking into 30 Rock and people are sharing it all over the internet because they can't wait to see what he's going to do.
But I still wonder why he has decided to do this. And also, we should say that this was agreed upon before we knew that Trump would be the next president.
Well, I think there was a sense that regardless of who won, you would want to hear from somebody like Dave Chappelle. So I think it made sense to have him. I mean, he's done a series of stand-up gigs in New York City, and so maybe that is why they thought it would be a good time to have him host a show that he'd already be in town. But as I said before, you know, he hasn't really done a major, you know, TV appearance like this. So to me, it makes all kinds of sense to, I mean, you know, no matter what he was doing, to have him on the Saturday Night Live after the election.
Well, how is this likely to go? Because Dave Chappelle has been somewhat unpredictable in his stand-up performances, also very incisive. Here he is in a clip from his 2004 comedy tour For What It's Worth.
A lot of black people don't have the privilege of knowing about grape juice because they have grape drink. It's not the same formula that you get. Ain't no vitamins in that. You might have one of your black friends over. Todd, would you care for a glass of grape juice? What is juice? I want some grape drink, baby.
So you hear that. And also, I remember, Eric, one of my favorite Dave Chappelle sketches was he did the Black Bush, where it was as if George W. Bush had been a black person.
Right. I suspect that whoever's working the 5-second delay is going to be very nervous on Saturday night. But, you know, what's interesting to me about Dave Chappelle, you know, when he left his Comedy Central show and then he went to Africa for a while and then he came back and did stand up, I covered when he came back. I saw him in Atlanta and I caught him after the show and talked to him a little bit. And what was interesting to me and what seemed to come through is that he gets very frustrated when he feels like the press or the public willfully misunderstands, in his mind, his very contradictory, complex, and incisive humor. He can go up on stage and talk about race and class and all these really touchy subjects and even contradict himself sometimes to the point where you're not quite sure where he stands on an issue. And then people assume that they know, but they get it wrong, and then it frustrates him. And I think that's one reason why he may have decided to step away from his Comedy Central show, that he felt like he was doing a lot of sketches that a huge percentage of his audience was not understanding in the way that he wanted them to.
And do we have any sense of his politics?
Well, it's interesting. You know, like I said, he did some stand-up in New York, and apparently he did a routine where he was skeptical about all the outrage over the Access Hollywood video of Donald Trump talking about what he wanted to do to women. That was read by the New York Observer as him supporting Trump. And then Chappelle's people sort of went out and sort of said that they felt that wasn't true. He voted for Hillary Clinton. So like I said, you know, he can have very complex and sometimes seemingly contradictory takes on an issue. I can't wait to see what he does on Saturday, because we don't really know what he's going to say. Will he get up there and say that Hillary deserved to lose? Will he get up there and have a different take on Trump that the rest of us didn't see? I hope, actually, that we will see something new and surprising and incisive that will make us think about all of this in a different way.
Well, I'll say one thing, which is that we talk to you every week about things that are going on TV, and I haven't heard you this excited about one of them in a while. So this is really, we can't wait to see SNL with Dave Chappelle.
I wasn't like this about the Gilmore Girls or, I don't think or Fuller so. House. I wasn't like it.
Definitely not Fuller House.
You're lucky I didn't do my Dave Chappelle impersonation. That's all I'm saying.
Eric Deggans, who is NPR's TV critic, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you very much, man.
Oh, see, there it is. We couldn't get away without it.
There it was.